What if you could have a career where the opportunities are as vast as our nation, where it's not about mission statements, but a shared mission? At U.S. Customs and Border Protection, we go beyond to protect more than borders. From ship to shore, air to ground, cities to local communities, CBP agents and officers are keeping people safe. Join U.S. Customs and Border Protection and go beyond for something far greater than yourself. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Interest in the Menendez brothers' case has exploded in the last few months. Over 770 million views on TikTok. The groundswell began in 2017 with the TV premieres of several documentaries and NBC's 8-episode limited series Law & Order True Crime, The Menendez Murders. Social media users were overwhelmingly sympathetic to the brothers during the NBC show, which debuted during the early days of the Me Too and Men Too era. Investigative journalist and author Robert Rand's 2018 book, The Menendez Murders, provided the primary source material for NBC series Plug, streaming on Amazon, YouTube, and Google Play. The NBC series was a 180-degree flip from the general perception that the brothers were just greedy rich kids who killed Ozzie and Harriet on a quiet Sunday night in Beverly Hills. There was little internet or social media when the brothers went on trial in 1993. Earlier this year, the current explosion of passionate Menendez advocates caught the attention of the New York Times with an article, "The New Menendez Defenders: Young People Are Making Impassioned Arguments for the Release of Lyle and Eric Menendez. Why Now?" On April 2, 2021, ABC's 2020 aired a two-hour special about the international movement of new Menendez supporters. Robert Rand continues to actively repost on the case. Some of the research included in his book, The Menendez Murders, could become significant new evidence when the brothers file an appeal. New evidence has surfaced leading to an appeal court filing later this year and a possible third trial for Lyle and Eric Menendez. The program this evening is The New Menendez Defenders, the international movement of supporters who want Lyle and Eric set free, with my special guest journalist and author, Robert Rand. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Robert Rand.
Thanks for having me back, Dan. I believe we last spoke about 18 months ago.
Yes, it's been quite a while, and an incredible amount of new information and progress in this case after 31 years has occurred. Incredible. Let's take
I was just going to say, this will sound hard to believe, but I am still actively reporting on new information connected to the Menendez brothers case. There are people that I've been trying to get to talk to me for 20 years, and some of them have actually come out of the woodwork in the last few months.
Interesting. Before we start, all that new information that you did we're privy to and do have that new information to share with the audience this evening. Tell us about your 14-year-old son and the information he imparted to you one day.
Well, one day last fall, in October 2020, my 14-year-old son came to me one afternoon and said, "Dad, you have to come take a look at TikTok. It's full of Menendez Brothers videos." And kind of was surprised, and you know, he was showing me his phone. And the videos that I was seeing back last fall were kind of frivolous. There were a lot of young women that were lip-syncing to the Britney Spears song, "Mama, I'm in Love with a Criminal." And they were cutting in video of Eric and Lyle Menendez when they were 18 and 21 at their first court appearance in March of 1990. Today, by the way, they are 53 and 50. But after the first few weeks of seeing some of those initial videos, I was following the posts on TikTok and Instagram. And I noticed that everything took a turn at some point in November 2020, and the videos started becoming more serious. People were starting to post about the issues. They were getting involved in the specific details of the case, a lot of minutia. And one of the ways that people can learn about the Menendez case in 2020 is Court TV. The old Court TV was rebooted a couple years ago. And in June of 2020, Court TV posted the entire six-month-long Menendez trial streaming on their website. And so you can actually watch every moment of the trial, including the evidence hearings, on Court TV. And so people were watching the Court TV stream. They were also watching documentaries. And as I saw this movement start to grow, I started picking up a lot of followers on social media. I started interacting with people who were not just in the States, but were all over the world. And there is a group of people that have become thousands of accounts on social media, and people all over the world that are very, they want to see the Menendez brothers have their case reviewed. They would like to see them be granted a new trial, and they would like to see them be released from state prison after 31 years in custody.
Now, you say the perception has changed. I've read an introduction from that these guys were just greedy rich kids that killed Ozzie and Harriet in Beverly Hills. So what are the issues that this new movement seems to identify and are concerned with, and think that there are issues that are deserving of Lyle and Eric to have a new trial?
I think the biggest issue is that society has changed so much from July of 1993, when the Menendez brothers went on trial in their first of two trials. And as you said in your intro, in the fall of 2017, the New York Times published their first Me Too and Men Too hashtag stories. And actually, an interesting thing that happened was the NBC Law & Order True Crime, the Menendez Murder Series, premiered the last week in September. And on October 5th, the New York Times ran their first story about Hartu and Mentu stories. And so I was following social media during the NBC series, and I was surprised. I was expecting to see a lot of the 1990s haters come out of the woodwork, the people that, mm-hmm. you know, branded them greedy rich kids. That, you know, they were following the stories that were being, you know, it was really the way the mainstream media was presenting the case as a pair of greedy rich kids. And so it was interesting to see that there was a new younger generation that wasn't even born during the first trial that had a new take on the story. And one of the things I found it interesting about that was that people were reexamining this case in light of the changes that we've had in society since 1993. And I believe right. if the Menendez brothers trial were held today, or if they were granted a new trial, there would be a completely different outcome. The resolution of this case should have been manslaughter, not murder, which still would have sent them to prison for 22 years. And now they've been in jail for 31 years.
You talk about, just while we're at that right there, you talk about that the original jurors, you say several of those jurors had said that the issue of the familial abuse, the father's abuse on Eric and Lyle, came out and was allowed at the mitigating, the sentencing phase, and it was a mitigating circumstance, they got to hear that. And the jurors, as a result, said, what did you say that the jurors, several of the jurors, said once they knew that information?
Well, let me back up for a moment and just explain. In the first Menendez trial, the defense was allowed to put on 65 witnesses, teachers, coaches, family members, friends, who told a detailed history of the Menendez family. In the second trial, Judge Stanley Weisberg reversed most of his evidence rulings, and he did not allow the defense to put on that information and those witnesses in the guilt phase. And in a final death blow to the defense, in the closing days of the second trial, he ruled that the defense would not be allowed to argue imperfect self-defense, which had been the heart of their case and the heart of their closing arguments in the first trial. So the brothers were convicted by a jury in the second trial that heard a completely different set of evidence from the jurors in the first trial. In the first trial, half of the jurors, there were two juries, one for each brother, half of the jurors voted for manslaughter. In the second trial, jurors heard a different set of evidence. They voted for a first-degree murder conviction in March of 1996, and following that conviction, there was a phase in which the jurors had two choices, either to sentence the brothers to life without parole or sentence them to the gas chamber in California.
Right.
And so in the penalty phase, the defense was allowed to put on all of those witnesses in the family history that had been the heart of their main case in the first Menendez trial. And after the penalty phase was over, the jurors voted for life without parole. I interviewed a number of the jurors, and several of them told me if they had heard that evidence about the family history in the guilt phase, they would not have voted for first-degree murder.
Certainly. Now, you provide what you call scoops. And so in your book, Chapter 60, you talk about a person named a cousin of Eric Menendez, Andy Cano. But tell us a little bit about Andy Cano's mother, Marta, and your discovery once you spoke to her.
Sure. Well, Andy Cano was a key defense witness in both trials when he was 10 years old and Eric was 12. And Eric had a conversation with him one day in which he asked him if his father ever massaged him in his genitals. And Andy Cano was kind of shocked and asked a few more questions. And when he heard the information, 10-year-old Andy Cano wanted to run and tell his mother. And Eric Menendez stopped him and said, "No, you can't ever tell anybody about this." And Eric made Andy swear on a pinky promise that he would never say anything to anybody about the molestation that was going on in the Menendez family. And the two cousins had a very close relationship. And in March of 2018, when I was on the deadline for my Menendez book, The Menendez Murders, I was visiting the brother's aunt, Marta Cano, at her home in Florida, and she allowed me to go through some boxes of papers of her son. Andy Cano tragically passed away in 2003 from an accidental overdose of sleeping pills. He was very traumatized by the whole experience of seeing his cousin he was very close to go through this trial, testifying in both trials. And Andy Cano was going through some troubles of his own. And so in March of 2018, Marta Cano pulled down some boxes from the attic of her house. And within 15 minutes after I began going through Andy Cano's, I found a letter that Eric Menendez had written to Andy Cano in December of 1988, 9 months before the murders, in which Eric Menendez was complaining about the ongoing abuse by his father, and Eric Menendez was 17 years old at the time.
Why do you think this is? I know this is a different time, and we have a different mentality and sensibility, but how important is that evidence, and what does it say compared to the other evidence that the defense had at some point, or at least they mentioned in the penalty phase of the second trial? So why is this so crucial information and evidence in your mind?
Well, first, the Eric Menendez letter to Andy Cano, that never came into either trial. That never appeared in any evidence hearing. Nobody knew it existed until I found it in the attic of Eric's aunt, Martha Cano. So that is a brand new piece of evidence. There's additional evidence that I've been going through the hundreds of audio taped interviews that I've conducted. I've covered this case since August 21st, 1989, less than 12 hours after the Menendez murders in Beverly Hills. And my audio tape interviews begin with Eric and Lyle Menendez in October of 1989, 2 months after the murders, 5 months before they were arrested. And the brothers were not suspects publicly. I had no reason to be suspicious of them. And we spent 3 days talking together, and they told me how much they loved their parents and how close-knit the family was. And so I'm now going through these audio tapes, and I never had the time, because I was actively involved in the coverage of the trial, I never had the time to transcribe things. And so I had a lot of interviews that I had recorded. For example, I might have a 1990s audio cassette, 45 minutes on each side, with maybe 6 or 8 different people on that tape. And I had the names of the people on the tape, but I didn't have the content transcribed. And what I have found in the last year is information from friends of Lyle Menendez who knew about the molestation that was going on in the Menendez family 4 or 5 months before the murders. And those are witnesses' information that never appeared in either trial.
You also spoke to Marta, which was Jose's sister, and there's some disturbing information you got about his background or their background growing up.
That's right. About 10 or 12 years ago, Marta Cano was my original entry into the Menendez family. I met her a couple weeks after the murders when I was working for the Miami Herald. And my original assignment for the Miami Herald Sunday Magazine in 1989 was to write a biography about Jose Menendez. Cuban-American rags-to-riches story ends in a terrible tragedy, because the murders were in August of 89, but the brothers were not arrested until March of 1990. So I was working on this biography of Jose Menendez. And as I said, the brothers were not suspects publicly. I had no reason to be suspicious of them. So I have known Marta Cano since September of 1989. And about 10 or 12 years ago, she made a cryptic comment to me in which she said, "After my mother passes away, I'm going to reveal some information to you." And fast forward to the spring of 2018, when Marta Cano sat down with me one day and told me that her mother had been sexually molesting Jose Menendez, her brother, between the ages of about 4 and 7 years old. And this was shocking information to me, again, something that had never come into either trial. And right around that same time, I was able to confirm with Kitty Menendez's sister that Kitty Menendez had been sexually molested by an older family member when she was a little girl. So these were two significant pieces of information. I've learned through research that about one-third of abuse victims grow up and abuse children when they are adults. Of course, that means, you know, two-thirds do not. But this was new information that had never come into either trial. And I think what the most important one-line summary I can tell people about the Menendez case is this is a story of intergenerational sexual abuse and mental illness. And this the way people approach the Menendez case, journalists that are covering it, is they try to take this, you know, square peg and put it in a round hole and say, you know, and try to present it as a traditional true crime story. And this is not a traditional true crime story. The Menendez family saga is this family background and what happened in this family that had trouble going back generations, including the brother's grandmother, who molested Jose Menendez. She grew up in a household in a small town in Cuba called Artemisa with 5 older brothers and a couple uncles, and she was sexually molested when she was a little girl. So this is a typical situation that I've learned about in my research about abuse and molestation, where the abuse jumps from generation to generation.
You talk about also, I know we're, I'm changing subjects a little bit, but the incredible story of Dr. Jerome Oziel. Is there any, I know you don't mention it per se, but is there any issue you have with this evidence, this usually what would be considered confidential information between a patient and client, coming out in the way that it did, this information being admissible at court? Do you have any issue with that ruling, and do you think anyone else will if there's a potential third trial?
Well, the story of Dr. Jerome Oziel and his mistress, Judilon Smith, could be a book in itself. Dr.
Sure.
Oziel was a therapist that Eric Menendez met in the fall of 1988 when both of the Menendez brothers were involved in some burglaries in Calabasas, a suburb of Los Angeles. And Eric Menendez was arrested and had a case that was in juvenile court in L.A. County. And as part of the resolution of that case, the juvenile court judge ordered that he undergo an evaluation by a therapist. And Kitty Menendez was actually seeing two different therapists on her own at that time. And one of them mm-hmm. referred her to Dr. Jerome Oziel, a Beverly Hills psychologist. And oddly, Dr. Oziel's specialty was sexual therapy for couples. But he was just hired by the Menendez family to do an evaluation of Eric. And then Eric did have some additional therapy sessions with Dr. Oziel after initially meeting him in the spring of 1989. That's information that has never come out actually in any media. Fast forward to the murders are August of 1989, and I spent 3 days talking to Eric and Lyle Menendez on the weekend of October 20th, 1989. And this was always interesting to me. On Halloween 1989, about 11 days after I met with the brothers, Eric Menendez called Dr. Oziel, the only therapist he had ever known, and said that he was very troubled and that he needed to meet with him. And on Halloween 1989, Eric Menendez confessed to Dr. Oziel that the Menendez brothers were responsible for killing their parents. Dr. Oziel, within a few minutes, said, "Eric, you need to call your brother, and I want him to come to the office right away." And it was Halloween. Lyle Menendez was at the Menendez mansion passing out candy to kids with his girlfriend. And he raced mm-hmm. over to Dr. Oziel's office, and he was very upset when he found out brother had confessed to Dr. Oziel. And the brothers met with Dr. Oziel for about an hour, and Lyle Menendez became frustrated and grabbed Eric and said, "I don't want to continue talking to him. Let's leave." And Dr. Oziel followed the brothers out into the hallway, and at the elevator, Dr. Oziel testified during the first Menendez trial that Lyle Menendez Dr. Oziel was trying to get the brothers to come back and continue the therapy session. And Lyle Menendez right. said, "Nope, I'm out of here." And according to Dr. Oziel's testimony, Lyle Menendez turned to him and shook his hand and said, "Good luck, Dr. Oziel." And then the brothers left. And in his testimony, Dr. Oziel claimed that he interpreted that handshake and that phrase, "Good luck, Dr. Oziel," as a threat from Lyle Menendez.
Right.
Normally, you have a privilege with a therapist in California, like every other state, in which anything you discuss with your therapist is privileged and confidential. But there is an exception in California called the Tarasoff Rule, which is if you threaten your therapist, or, for example, if you tell your therapist, "I'm going to go kill my girlfriend tomorrow," the therapist is obligated to break the privilege and contact law enforcement in that specific situation. Or in the situation of if you threaten your therapist, the therapist is allowed to break the confidentiality and tell people around him in order to protect them, in order to keep them safe. And so Dr. Oziel's story is that he was threatened by Lyle Menendez, and that he had to tell his wife, his mistress. He had a whole circle of people that he told about the brother's confession. And then the brothers continued having therapy sessions with Dr. Oziel. And in the subsequent sessions that took place in November of 1989, the power balance in the relationship kind of shifted, and Dr. Ozeal kind of felt like he was in control of things. And according to accusations the defense made during the first Menendez trial, Dr. Ozeal was blackmailing the Menendez brothers. And the evidence of that, according to the family and the defense, is that he told the brothers that he was going to schedule therapy sessions for them 5 days a week, one session for each brother. And according to the defense evidence, the brothers never went to any of those therapy sessions, but he was billing the family. And Dr. Ozeal, according to the brothers and the family, made it clear that I don't care if you ever show up for these therapy sessions, I'm billing your family. And so the family members started getting these large bills, $8,000, $10,000, $12,000. And they were asking the brothers, what's going on? And the brothers said, no, Aunt Martha, these therapy sessions are important. We want to continue seeing Dr. Ozeal. So that's one of a series of strange facts in Dr. Ozeal's background. And then in December of 1989, in another twist in this case that you couldn't make up if you were writing a fiction novel or a movie, the Menendez brothers had contacted a high-profile criminal defense attorney by the name of Gerald Chaliff in Los Angeles. Gerald Chaliff represented the Hillside Strangler in one of L.A.'s numerous high-profile cases. And Gerald Chaliff and Dr. Ozeal had a meeting one afternoon in which they decided that they were going to record an audio tape of a therapy session with the Menendez brothers. And I'm going to put air quotes around the session because Gerald Chaliff and Dr. Ozeal met for an hour and kind of went over, basically kind of outlined a script of what was going to happen in this recording. And then Gerald Chaliff left the office. Dr. Ozeal turned on the tape recorder and he recorded a 1 hour audio tape that included the Menendez brothers admitting they were responsible for killing their parents. And that tape would normally have been privileged under California's therapy laws, but this was an issue that delayed the trial for 3 years between the arrest in March of 90 and the trial that began in July of 93. And the issue of the privilege went all the way to the California Supreme Court. And the California Supreme Court ruled that the tape, you know, could be allowed as evidence because of what Dr. Ozeal claimed was a threat that had been made by the Menendez brothers. But it would have been a really interesting case. It kind of would have been the emperor's new clothes if the Supreme Court had ruled against allowing that tape as evidence. The Menendez defense would have been, you say we killed our parents? Prove it.
It's interesting, too, that there was at least some deception, to say the least, of outright lying by Dr. Ozeal's mistress, which becomes muddies this water completely because she certainly moves in with he and his wife, and then she is the person that calls police saying that she actually heard the confessions either through the wall or through the door, and you investigated that claim. That would have been one of their witnesses.
And again, Dr. Ozeal was the star prosecution witness in the first Menendez trial. But as I said a moment ago, you could write a book about the relationship between Dr. Ozeal and his mistress. And again, it details that you can't imagine making up. Jude Lund Smith, Dr. Ozeal's paramour, claimed that she was in the waiting room of Dr. Ozeal's office on the day that Eric Menendez confessed. And she said that she overheard things from the waiting room, from the therapy room to the waiting room. And I interviewed Dr. Ozeal in late 1990 and early 1991 for a very long article I wrote for Playboy magazine that came out in March of 91. And one of the first, when Dr. Ozeal agreed to do an interview with me, the first thing I said to him was, I want to come over to your office with a couple friends, and I want to do a sound check. And I want to find out if you can hear anything from the therapy room, which was way down at the end of a long hallway, and the waiting room. And he immediately said yes. And I knew at that moment I didn't really have to do that test because I knew she was lying. I knew she made up that story. But I went ahead and went over to the office with two friends, and we spent an hour, you know, trying to do, you know, various versions, you know, with the door closed, the door open a crack, you know, with different people in the waiting room, and we couldn't hear a thing. And so I realized, my conclusion was that Dr. Ozeal gossiped with his girlfriend, and I believe he was trying to save his career. And the story that he came up with, or they came up with, you know, I'm still not sure of the exact details. It's so murky. But I believe the story that they came up with was that she was going to say that she overheard the confession. And then, in an even stranger twist, Dr. Ozeal moves June Lon Smith, his mistress, into his house with his wife and his two young daughters, who were 8 and 10 years old, and he is basically trying to keep the lid on June Lon Smith because their relationship was going sour, and so she was threatening to go to the police and tell the police that the Menendez brothers killed their parents, and Dr. Jerome Ozeal has an audio tape with their confession. And Dr. Ozeal was married to a therapist, and yet his wife allowed, you know, June Lon Smith to, you know, move into their home, and things kept spinning out of control for several months. And so while, according to the defense, Dr. Ozeal is blackmailing the Menendez brothers, he has his own drama going on at home with his girlfriend living in the house with his wife and two young daughters. And finally, Dr. Ozeal and his wife, Laurel, kicked June Lon Smith out of their home the first week in March of 1990. And a couple days later, she went to the L.A. County DA's office and the Beverly Hills Police and said, Eric and Lyle Menendez killed their parents, and Dr. Jerome Ozeal has an audio tape in a safe deposit box of their confession. And that's how the brothers were arrested, because of Dr. Ozeal's mistress revealing this information. And again, these are twists that you just can't imagine making up if you were writing a fictional murder story.
No, certainly. Let's use this opportunity, Robert, to stop for these messages.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, we talked about that these confessions, normally, they would have been on these audio tapes without the lies and the call from this Judalana Smythe, then this information would, it would not have come to the attention of the police. You talk about other information.
Yeah,
go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, the interesting thing was that Beverly Hills Police had been investigating the Menendez murder case for 7 months, and at a certain point, I was aware that the investigation was focused solely on the brothers, but the reality was the Beverly Hills Police really did not have much evidence. They knew the brothers were spending a lot of money. That became a big issue in the media. But they really didn't have hard evidence to make an arrest. And if I could interject one factoid here, a very important factoid about the Menendez case. The mainstream media, from the moment the brothers were arrested and through both of their trials, kept repeating this information that they were greedy rich kids that were in a hurry to inherit their parents' $14 million estate. And the reality was that in August of 1992, the LA County DA's office went to a grand jury and presented evidence of murder for financial gain, and the grand jury did not return an indictment on those charges. So, in spite of not having an indictment on murder for financial gain, the prosecution, the LA County DA's office has a dozen people that do public relations, and their job is to bid on these high-profile cases and, in my opinion, poison the potential jury pool. And so in spite of not having an indictment, they kept pushing this greedy rich kids, and that was, you know, if you went up to anybody on the street in 1993 at the time of the first trial and said, who are the Menendez brothers? They would probably reply, oh, those greedy rich kids that killed their parents.
You write that in Chapter 56, with the second trial, you talk about also that the public was misled by the media. The jurors actually believed that these people would go free. So when we talked about that these jurors, if they would have heard that other information about the family abuse, would have voted differently. But also, was there that much pressure from the media that even the jurors believe that these people, if they didn't vote the right way, if they didn't judge the right way, these people would be sent free, these two brothers?
Well, as I said, as I mentioned before, in the first Menendez trial, half of the jurors, there were two juries, one for each brother, because some of the evidence only pertained to one or the other, and half of those jurors in the first trial voted for manslaughter. For some reason, the general public, because of being confused by stories in the mainstream media, the general public thought those jurors voting for manslaughter wanted to let the brothers walk out of jail and be acquitted. And nobody on either juror wanted to acquit the brothers. A manslaughter conviction would have sent the brothers to jail for 22 years, 11 years on each count. And so that was one major point of confusion in the public's interpretation of the case. Nobody wanted to let the brothers out of jail. But the manslaughter jurors were, really took a beating on talk radio in Los Angeles after the first trial. People were outraged. They were going on talk radio and screaming, "What's wrong with those stupid jurors? The brothers admitted they killed their parents. Why couldn't they convict them of murder?" And there was a radio station in L.A., KFI Radio, a show called John and Ken, host a longtime popular show in L.A., hosted by a couple of conservative talk show hosts. And they were almost daily bashing the Menendez brothers and would have a segment about the case between 5 and 6 p.m. It just happened to be the time of day when the jurors were driving home from the trial. And a lot of people in L.A. listened to this radio talk show. And in fact, in the spring of 1994, after the first trial, the Menendez family was out of money. And Leslie Abramson, the lead attorney with the blonde curly hair that many people were familiar with, was trying to get court appointed. She eventually was court appointed at $125 an hour. And she talked about that she was going to start raising money for a Menendez defense fund. And so John and Ken Fosco on KFI Radio in L.A., they came on one day and said, "We're going to have a fundraiser for the L.A. County DA's office. And the title of our fundraiser is Fry the Menendez." And they actually staged an event and, had their live radio show with 3,000 or 4,000 people at a park in downtown L.A. in which people were making contributions to the L.A. County DA's office. Again, so many details.
You write that when this was appealed, that the judge presiding over that appeal made a comment. But that you write about that O.J. Simpson and the Rodney King decision made the L.A. County District Attorney's Office very, very anxious about this case and very, very anxious to have a win. Can you discuss that a bit?
That's right, Dan. I mean, the politics in Los Angeles had a major impact on the Menendez brothers case, unfortunately for them. And this goes back to in the late 80s, there was a case called the McMartin preschool trial, a sexual molestation case that was a very high profile media case in Los Angeles, which was portrayed by the DA's office as that a family that owned a preschool had been molesting children for years, and the media grabbed onto the story, very big story in L.A., and that case ended with the acquittal of all the defendants. So there's big loss number one. Then we have the Rodney King beating trial, the famous videotape of the beating of Rodney King by LAPD officers, and four LAPD officers went on trial. And that trial ended with an acquittal of all four officers, and that verdict set off riots in L.A. that went on for 10 days and killed dozens of people and resulted in millions of dollars of damage to businesses in Southern California. And then comes along a couple of years after the Rodney King trial, comes the first Menendez case. It ends with neither jury could reach a verdict, so it ends with two mistrials. The public is outraged. And then in June of 1994, we have the O.J. Simpson murders, the murder of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. And The O.J. Simpson trial took place in 1995, and the O.J. verdict was on October 3rd, 1995, and the second Menendez trial had the misfortune of starting the day after the O.J. verdict. So at this point in the L.A. County DA's office, they were desperate for a win. They were going to do whatever it took to convict the Menendez brothers, and so it was really kind of a series of it was just bad timing that they followed all of these losses, and the DA's office was so focused that they were going to convict the Menendez brothers. And as you mentioned, when the Menendez brothers had their last appeal in front of the Ninth Circuit in 2005, and Justice Alex Kaczynski actually made a statement during their appeal hearing in which he said he believed there had been collusion between the L.A. County DA's office and the trial judge, Stanley Weisberg, to convict the Menendez brothers. And there's actually an audio tape you can search and find on the internet and hear that, you know, actually hear the hearing. But in spite of making that statement, Justice Kaczynski voted against the appeal. But it's a very interesting statement that he made.
You talk about the information, the new evidence that's going to get these brothers to file appeals. Yeah, you know, this later this year. You talk about that information. Talk about that.
Sure.
The new evidence that you believe will compel this appeal court first, but also why that information. Why that evidence will, you think, will succeed?
Well, that's several questions in one, so let me break it down. The first basic piece of information is that the Menendez brothers have exhausted all of their state and federal appeals. They have no appeals left. They have three options that are on the table. Three different legal avenues they can take to try and reopen their case. The two of those options are they could file, request a pardon from Gavin Newsom, the governor of California. They could also make a separate filing requesting clemency from the governor of California. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that's probably pretty unlikely that would ever happen. I would refer people to the situation with Leslie Van Houten, one of the Manson family members, who actually has been granted a release, parole and a release, three or four times over the last 5 years by the California Parole Board. And each time that the parole board said she could be released, Governor Jerry Brown blocked her release the first time, and Gavin Newsom has blocked her release two additional times. And so Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom, traditionally liberal governors, politically liberal people, and they blocked her release. And Leslie Van Houten is 70 years old. She was 20 years old when she was involved in the Manson murders. And my friend Linda Deutsch, the famous AP trial correspondent, wrote a really powerful op-ed a few years ago that appeared in the LA Times that people can search and read. And Linda Deutsch actually has been in contact with Leslie Van Houten over the last 10 years. And Linda Deutsch's point of view was that, Leslie Van Houten should be released. If the purpose of prisons is to rehabilitate people, Leslie Van Houten is certainly an example of that. 50 years after a crime she committed when she was 20 years old and high on drugs, are we ever going to show some compassion for Leslie Van Houten? And the answer is probably not, because she was a member of the notorious Manson family, and people and no governor of California, regardless of their politics, is probably ever going to release a member of the Manson family. And so the Menendez brothers, that's why filing for a pardon or filing for a clemency is probably a real long shot. So the third avenue, and what they are likely to do, is they will file what's called a habeas corpus petition. And that is going to the appeal court and saying there is new evidence that we have since the trials that we'd like the appeal court to consider. And also you know, that they have a major legal issue, which is that they were not allowed to present all of their evidence of being abused in the second trial where they were convicted. And
right.
There are two other factors in California. In 2015, California passed new youth offender laws that were based on new medical research that said a brain is not fully developed until the age of 25. So in California, any defendant who is under 25 at the time of their crime is allowed to apply for a review of their case based on those laws. But there's one exception to that 2015 law, and that is if you were sentenced to life without parole, you're not eligible to apply for that review. And to me, that makes no sense at all. Either everybody under 25 gets to apply for a review or, you know, what's the point of the law? And then there's another California law that was passed in, I think, 2017 or 2018, dealing with if you were not allowed to present evidence of abuse at your trial, that you have another avenue to ask for a review of your case. But what I believe what's going to happen is that the brothers will file a habeas corpus petition based on new evidence, some of which I had in my book, some of which I've discovered in the last year in reporting, and also the legal issues that they were not allowed to put on their full defense in their second trial where they were convicted of first-degree murder.
And do you think that given all of the information, and you know, in your book you provide all of the murderous information about how these boys took 12-gauge rifles and reloaded three times, killed their mother, killed their father. The sentiments and the emotions that are there and that were there and the evidence that were presented to the jurors in this potential new trial, how do you believe that they can, what is the goal? Is it a second-degree murder conviction, or is it the manslaughter, even though you say that manslaughter is an average of 20 to 25 years? What is the real, I guess, achievable goal for them?
Let me just correct you on one quick fact. They reloaded their guns twice. You can't get around the basic facts. Eric Lyle Menendez went to San Diego and they purchased two shotguns on August 18th, 2 days before they killed their parents. And it's pretty hard to argue, you know, that doesn't look like premeditation. But
right.
The general public was confused about Menendez's defense. The general public, again, because of what they were consuming in the mainstream media, the general public thought that the Menendez defense was, we were sexually molested, we were abused, therefore we get a free pass to kill our parents. That was not the legal defense. The legal defense was that we were in fear for our lives after there were a series of confrontations the brothers testified about in the days leading up to the murders. And the brothers claimed that they went to buy guns because they thought their parents were going to kill them. Here's another interesting little factoid. Kitty Menendez had two rifles in her closet with ammunition.
Wow.
And there was an interesting statement that Jill Lansing, Lyle Menendez's lead defense attorney, made in her closing argument, in which she said, the brothers, on the night that the brothers killed their parents, they read the signals and they read the signals wrong. Because it's really easy for us, you know, looking at it from a logical perspective and from, you know, a normal mind, to say, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. How could they have thought that their parents were going to kill them? But the research I've done into abuse survivors and the trauma that they experienced, and again, this is based on detailed testimony from 65 teachers, coaches, families, and friends, it gives you a completely different picture of the brothers. The number one question people ask me is, they say they were 18 and 21 years old. Why didn't they just walk out the front door if things were so bad at home? And the answer to that question is, the therapy experts have explained to me that the emotional maturity of the Menendez brothers is somewhere between 8 and 10 years old. The parents had made them very dependent on them. The parents used to do their homework And it didn't take teachers long to figure out that the homework was always perfect, and they'd take a test in school and fail. The parents would tell them who they could be friends with, who they could date. They controlled every aspect of their lives down to the tiniest detail. And here's another bizarre factoid. Jose and Kitty Menendez had bugged both Eric and Lyle Menendez's bedrooms. They had microphones and taping equipment, and they were taping all of their phone calls. Got to ask, you know, what normal parent, you know, puts hidden recording equipment in their kids' bedroom so they can record all their phone calls? So this was a strange family.
I also read in your book, too, about the strange demands. I mean, this person was an overachiever, Jose, and Kitty, to a great extent, being this beauty queen. And he was a very demanding person. Again, the sexual abuse is one thing, but if that was taken out of this equation, he still was a very demanding, and this was a very stressful household, wasn't it? And the marriage was on the rocks as well.
Yes, and I mentioned earlier, there were 65 witnesses for the defense, teachers, coaches, and family friends. These were eyewitnesses to physical, verbal, and emotional abuse. In my opinion, that could be just as traumatic to a 5 or 6-year-old as a sexual molestation. But growing up in the Menendez household was a very strange place. And the number two question that people always ask me is, okay, I might be willing to accept that Jose Menendez was a monster, but what about their mother? Why did they kill their mother? Because we all assume that all mothers are loving and nurturing and caring. And the reality is, unfortunately, that's not true. And another key line in Leslie Abramson's closing argument for Eric Menendez, she said, Jose and Kitty Menendez ran boot camp Beverly Hills, and Kitty Menendez was one of the guards, not one of the prisoners. And in the brothers' testimony, in which they describe this series of confrontations in the days leading up to the murders, the brothers testified that they found out for the first time that Kitty Menendez told them that she knew about the abuse all along, and that she hadn't done anything to protect them. And by the way, there are some of these family members that the majority of the family members testified for the defense. And that is not typical of a murder case where the family members are supporting the defendants. And there were two cousins that lived with the family over several different summers. One of them, her name was Diane Vandermolen, and she testified in both trials that when Lyle Menendez was 8 years old, she was living with the family for the summer, and he came down to her room in the basement one night and said that he wanted to stay in her room, and he was complaining that his father was touching him down there. And Diane Vandermolen immediately went upstairs and talked to Kitty Menendez and said, you know, I'm really concerned. Lyle came in, you know, just told me this story of something weird going on. And according to Diane Vandermolen's testimony, Kitty Menendez said, oh, you know, don't listen to him. He's just making that up.
Yeah, incredible. You talk about this confrontation, too, and the dynamic of Eric being younger than Lyle and Eric being, Lyle being concerned. So tell us what you've written about that dynamic and the confrontation just days before the murder.
Well, growing up, Eric and Lyle Menendez had a very close relationship their entire lives. I mean, basically, they had each other as their closest friend, their closest confidant, because the parents were so controlling in telling them, you can be friends with this person, you can be friends with that person, but having such total control over their son's lives. And so the brothers really relied on each other, you know, throughout their lives growing up. And there was one point when Eric Menendez revealed some information about the molestation to Lyle when he was 13 years old. And, you know, Lyle was very young, 13 years old, and, you know, tried to say something to his father, but, you know, that didn't go anywhere. But Eric Menendez revealed to Lyle Menendez about a four or five days before the murders, before the series of confrontations, that the molestation by his father was still going on, and he was 10 years old, maybe 17 years old, 17 mm-hmm. or 18. But Lyle Menendez was shocked to hear that it was still going on, and he decided that he was going to confront his father. Jose Menendez was on the East Coast on a business trip, and the brothers kind of made a plan that Lyle was going to confront Jose and threaten to go to the police or threaten to go to other family members. And according to the brothers' testimony, these series of confrontations got more and more heated as the days went on. And when Lyle Menendez did confront his father, according to his testimony, Jose Menendez said, you know, you say you're going to reveal this to relatives or the police. I'm never going to let that happen. And the brothers have been told throughout their lives, as is typical with abusers, if you tell anybody, I'm going to kill you. And so you have to understand that the atmosphere, the world of, you know, the strange life behind the gates of the Menendez mansion that the brothers grew up in was not a typical situation. And that's, I think, the problem that the public has trying to filter this through, you know, our perspectives of, you know, normal logical thinking. And we look at some of these events and say, that's ridiculous. How could that ever happen? But when you learn the history of this family, that's when you find out the truth. And one of the most interesting things that I learned about the Menendez family and the defense attorneys, Jose Menendez was kind of the rich uncle in the Menendez family. A lot of the family was not so well off, but if you needed a loan, if you, one of your kids needed their first job, you went to Uncle Jose. And so nobody ever wanted to piss off the rich uncle, because you never knew when you might need the rich uncle. So after the brothers are arrested and the defense attorneys get all of these family members together in one room, and they all had bits and pieces of a puzzle, and they all started comparing notes, and the light bulbs started going off over everybody's head, and they were horrified to realize that, you know, some of their suspicions apparently were true.
What are the this? What are, what's the demeanor of Lyle and Eric now? When was the last time you spoke to them, and what do you think they're thinking right now? And what about their plans for this appeal?
Well, that's about three or four questions, but I'll break it down again. The last time I've been in regular contact with Lyle Menendez the past few years. Actually, before the pandemic, I was visiting him at Donovan Prison near San Diego about every 6 or 8 weeks, and we'd spend about 5 hours talking together, and we talk on the phone every couple of weeks. I have not been in contact with Eric Menendez for many years, but Eric Menendez was actually, I was in closer contact with him than Lyle during the trials. Both brothers used to call me frequently during the two Menendez trials. And so in 2021, they are both together. They were separated for 22 years. The LA County Probation Department recommended that they be placed in the same prison. And on the day of their sentencing, July 2nd, 1996, the Beverly Hills Police filed a motion and said, "We believe the Menendez brothers should not be sent to the same prison because they were co-conspirators in a crime, and if they are sent to the same facility, it's likely that they will co-conspire to commit a new crime." And that's ridiculous. Wow. That was completely done out of spite. And so for 22 years, the Menendez brothers had been in different prisons around California. They were not allowed to talk to each other on the phone. The only communication they had was through letters, or they could get information from each other's wives. Both brothers are married, by the way. In April of 2018, Lyle Menendez, in February 2018, filed for the sixth year in a row asking for a transfer to be with his brother, and the California Department of Corrections granted his request for a transfer. And both Lyle and myself believe that the NBC Law and Order True Crime Menendez Murder series might have been a factor in the California Department of Corrections granting his request for a transfer. And the brothers were reunited and saw each other for the first time in April 2018, and they now see each other every day, and they are grateful to be together. And the family is grateful that they are together. And both brothers have been really good citizens and members of their prison community. Lyle Menendez is very involved in the prison government. He was head of the prison government at Mule Creek State Prison for 15 years. He's an activist in prison reform. Eric Menendez created a hospice program at Donovan Prison, something he had done at his previous prison. He is also leading a weekly group in mindful meditation. Lyle leads a weekly group for prisoners who were abused when they were kids. And they are in the general population. They're both well liked. They have made the best of what they can out of their lives, and they're both very blessed. They both have loving, supportive wives, which is kind of a remarkable side tangent of the story. So they're doing the best they can, but and being contributing members to their prison community, but. The Menendez family would like to see them released from jail. Kitty Menendez's sister is 89 years old. Jose Menendez's sister Marta is going to turn 80 in July, and their wishes are they would like to see the brothers released before they die. And this new movement of Menendez supporters all over the world has caught all of us. That have been following the case closely, has caught all of us by surprise. And this movement is growing. It's not just something like a passing thing on social media, but I've been tracking it since my teenage son came to me last fall, told me about the first videos on TikTok, and there are new supporters every day. I'm picking up 50 to 100 new followers on my social media accounts every week, and it's been fascinating to me to interact with, many of these supporters are young kids, high school and college age, and I am so impressed with the research they are doing into the facts of the case, into the minutiae of the case, and one of the resources they have available is that the entire trial is available on CourtTV.com. And so they're watching the testimony of all the witnesses. They are getting into the transcripts, and I'm really kind of bowled over by the enthusiasm for these new supporters. But I also want to mention that even though the perception of the media again is that these are just kids, high school kids, college kids, I have been in touch with adult supporters in different parts of the world. One of the people I've spoken with is a NYPD officer. In New York, who believes the brothers should be released from jail. I've spoken to people in Germany that believe the same thing, adults. And there are a number of adults who were abused when they were kids that have been longtime supporters of the brothers, and there have been new members with that background in this supporter community. And in fact, when the brothers were on trial in 1993, their first trial, they were getting 1,000 letters a week from people all over the world. About half those awesome. Letters were from groupies, young girls that thought they were attractive and were interested in and watching the case on TV. But half of the letters the brothers were getting were from adults who had been abused when they were kids, and they wrote to Eric and Lyle Menendez and said, "Nobody believed me when I was a little kid, and I believe you." And when Lyle Menendez testified in the first trial, every day he was on the witness stand, he carried one of those letters in his pocket from a different abuse survivor.
Interesting. Fascinating. I know that this movement has been aided by things like ABC's 2020, the two-hour special, April 2nd, that was just recently, again, talking about the international movement of new Menendez supporters. But you have on your website a lot of the information, the links to the Court TV and the trial, and your appearance at the trial is very interesting, so I suggest people go and check that out. Very, very fascinating information you have on your site,
right,
the Menendez Murders.
Thank you. The website is MenendezMurders.com, easy to remember.
Yes. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the new Menendez Defenders, the international movement of supporters who want Lyle and Eric set free. Thank you so much, Robert Rand. And also, I just want to remind people that all of this information, these scoops that you talk about, likely evidence that will be in this new appeal and in the third trial, hopefully, is contained in the Menendez Murders. So thank you so much, Robert Rand, for the new Menendez Defenders. It's been fascinating speaking to you about all things new
with the Menendez brothers and their fight for a new trial.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dan. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.